Welcome to the X-Line, the show all about the Fujifilm X-Series cameras and the stories behind the gear. I'm Mark Sadowski, and this is Episode 8. I am so happy to finally bring you the interview with Chris Upton. Chris Upton is a fantastic landscape photographer from England. He has been featured on Fujifilm's official YouTube channel during the time where they launched the X-Pro2 and the XC2S. His was one of the vignettes that they did, featuring his photography and one of his incredible projects. So without further ado, let's check out the interview. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the X-Line show, where we have this week Chris Upton. He is a fabulous photographer in the UK, and let's get right to it. Chris, how's it going?
I'm fine, thanks, Mark. Thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Excellent. I have so many questions that I want to ask you, but enough about Brexit. I think we should just talk about photography.
quite topical, I think, and for a country that's gone out of Europe twice in a few days because of the performance of the football team, it's not a great time to be English at the moment, but there you go.
I actually missed that game. I wanted to see it so bad, but I kept hearing that like the announcers were just going nuts over it. And yeah. That's
highly, highly embarrassing, Mark, but there you go. Let's move on to photography.
Right on. So the first time I came across your work was during the launch of the Fuji X-Pro2. And Fujifilm did this tremendous thing where they created a number of vignettes that they placed on YouTube highlighting a number of photographers. And you were the first person I saw right next to, I believe, Peter Bridgewood, I think.
Pete Bridgewood, yeah.
Pete Bridgewood. Yeah, yeah. So yeah. You guys basically just, I mean, I was already sold on the Fuji X-Pro2 to begin with, but my God, sealing the deal with what you guys were doing was just incredible. And I wanted to just touch base with you because, one, your landscape photography is tremendous. Your Thoresby, how am I pronouncing it?
Thoresby Colliery. Yeah, that's Colliery. Correct.
That is some tremendous work as well. And I wanted to touch on that in a little bit.
Sure.
But before we get into, the Fuji series, let's go into your origin story. Were you doing photography before starting with the Fuji X series cameras?
Yes, I was, Mark. I mean, my photography started in my teens when I used to do a lot of walking and climbing in the UK, and the camera came along really to record those walks and climbs. So places like the Lake District and Scotland and North Wales, and I live in the centre of the country, so we're very near the Peak District, which is a huge national park and a very popular one. So the outdoors and the landscape was very, very dear to my heart. And as I say, it was a question of using the camera to capture that. But as time went on, I got more and more into the photography and less into the walking and climbing.
Yeah.
And that's basically just continued. And obviously, I've gone through the film days. And in the film days towards the end of my film period, I was using Nikon DSLRs. But when digital came along, I swapped to Canon, jumped ships to Canon, and I bought a Canon 10D, which seems crazy because it was a 6-megapixel sensor. And when you think now, just the size on your phone, yeah. It's amazing, really, to think that we thought they were fantastic cameras at the time. And I think that's a good point, because I think the bottom line is, whatever system you have at the moment, there are no bad cameras out there now. They're all pretty good cameras and can give you very good results, and it really just depends, I think, what you like yourself and how it works for you. And that's really important, I think. It's like the car that you drive or the clothes that you wear. You've got to be comfortable, and if you're comfortable, you'll perform better. But after the Canon digital days, there was a bit of a turning point for me, sort of fast forward to 2010. My son was doing his university degree in the UK, and as part of that, he had to spend a year abroad. 6 months of that, he happened to spend in New York, in Times Square, working at Reuters. And so we went over to see him a couple of times. And the first time we went, it was, I think it was Easter, the end of April. And I took along my rucksack with all my Canon gear in and walking around New York. And it was unseasonally warm. But walking around New York with a heavy rucksack on with maybe 10, 12 kilos of gear in and a tripod,
yeah,
it just became a grind. It really did. We went back to see him a couple of months later, and I just thought, I'm not doing that again. And I went and bought a Lumix, Panasonic Lumix G1, which was about to be discontinued. And I bought a couple of lenses with it, just a standard zoom and then a longer focal length zoom. And, you know, it was just liberating to walk around with a small shoulder bag, small light body, couple of lenses, and I really enjoyed it. And that was it was a turning point for me, really, because I just enjoyed it so much, and it was such a contrast with using the heavy, bulky, but brilliant. I mean, let's face it, you know, Canon gear is brilliant, as Nikon gear is, but for me in that situation, and as enjoying my travel and doing more and more travel photography, it's important that you can at least be comfortable in hot climates and be able to walk around and be comfortable and enjoy your photography. So I bought the Lumix. It performed really well. I was delighted with it. But it was a Micro Four Thirds sensor.
Yeah.
And I wasn't quite sure about that. The laws of physics tell me that a Micro Four Thirds isn't going to be as good as an APS-C or a full frame.
Yeah.
And then what happened was I had some experience with Olympus, because I won an Olympus OMD EM5, I think it was the first one. Beautiful cameras. I'd had an Olympus OM1 and OM2 in the film days. Gorgeous cameras, really well made, beautiful design. And I quite like the digital Olympus. But there was a couple of things with it for me. And one of the things I found to be a grind was on that particular model was that you had to dive into the menus to change anything.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a faff. And I think perhaps because I was still using the Canon and the Olympus occasionally, it wasn't second nature.
Right.
And I think they've probably updated that since, and it is much easier now. But at that time, I couldn't get on with it.
That's a huge thing. Like if it's not intuitive right away, then it becomes such a grind. I mean, when I'm of personal experience, when I first started using the Canon digital gear, I was able to for as intuitive as you could get with a camera menu system, it went pretty well. I was able to navigate it get to where I needed to go pretty quickly. And I had the same problem with the Olympus series. It's like, this one feels like it's more of a learning curve than usual.
Yeah, and unless you're used to it and unless you can change things quickly, you miss shots.
Yeah.
And, you know, particularly if it's sort of candid and I'm doing some travel stuff and I need to grab a portrait or get capture a point in time quickly, then it's annoying then, very annoying when you miss shots. And then what had happened was I'd always hankered after a little rangefinder camera. I'd love the Leica system, the look of it. I'd never had one, always fancied one. But, of course, the digital ones were very expensive, and I just couldn't justify that.
Kidding. Buy a house or buy a camera.
Absolutely. And then Fuji launched the X-Pro 1, which was really interesting. And I went to – there's a huge photo show in the UK. Went along to see it. And I wasn't quite convinced because – for me, I wanted something small, but the X-Pro 1 at the time was bigger than I'd anticipated, and I wasn't quite sure about it, so I left it. And then, of course, I think it was probably 9 months or a year later, they launched the X-E1, which absolutely ticked all the boxes. It was small, it was light, and I bought one, and I bought that with the 18-55 lens and a 35mm 1.4 lens, with the idea that it would just...
I actually missed that game. I wanted to see it so bad.
And a great walk around zoom lens. I got it. But of course, the bug had bitten me at this stage. And it was only when you then start taking the pictures and see the results that you think, wow, what is this thing all about?
Right.
Because I'd read that people were waxing lyrical about the quality of the JPEGs, but I'd never shot JPEGs for years because I was just shooting RAW. But I thought, I'll give this a go.
Well, who in their right mind would shoot JPEG only is basically the mentality that we had with these cameras.
Absolutely. And so I thought, well, I'll give it a go. shot the JPEGs, and I was just blown away by them. I mean, they were just incredible. And I know everybody talks about this. Everybody can't be wrong, I guess. But it is. And there's a feel. There's a feel. There's a certain feel to the Fuji images. It's a filmic feel. And I know they've got these wonderful film types. But there is a certain feel to them. And sometimes, you know, it's quite difficult to even get your RAWs to match some of the JPEGs.
I still fight with that.
So that was it. I was sold on it, and I started to use it more and more. I bought another lens. I bought the 55-200. Enjoyed it, using it more and more. Used the Canon less and less. And then when the X-T1 came out, I bought that, and then that was it. Then I've hardly used the Canon since, and the sort of stock presses that all the Canon gear is now up for sale. You know, it's going, and I'm just solely, well, I have only been using the Fuji really for the past couple of years.
Yeah.
So that's really the story, my journey into Fuji.
Nice. I have to say, like, I was quite the opposite. I loved the size and feel of the X Pro 1. When I tried the XE 1, it was kind of like, this is going to be the more affordable version of the X Pro 1. This is what I'll settle down with. And the XE 1 is, for me personally, the only Fuji camera that I absolutely hate. It is the slowest thing in the world.
Yeah. Well, I did say there's no bad camera. I think it's probably fair to say there's no perfect camera either.
Yes.
There's always things that we can say, well, it's either too big, too small, this is buttons in the wrong place, etc.
Well, we were using it for different things. I was using it for trying to use it for wedding photography, which didn't fit my style there. For landscapes and things, you don't have much movement involved. No. So no. I could see that being... why you won over. Now the XE2, holy crap, that was such a night and day improvement.
Yes.
I loved that beast. That was such a great camera.
Yes.
So let me ask you a little bit more about your landscape career. This is a thing where it's kind of everybody can be a landscape photographer, but it's extremely hard to master. And I have to say that just looking through your work, it's just mind blowing the amount of so many intangible things. Like the common eye will just know what they see and like it, but the what you do with your lines in your photography is just absolutely brilliant. When you go out to certain locations, what is that process? Do you have to explore an area first? Do you just kind of go out and shoot and just see what happens? Like, what is that experience for you?
Well, it's interesting because I've been talking about this in the last week, because I now do some workshops, some training. I was doing some one-to-one or a one-to-one with a guy. And basically, he just wanted me to do exactly what you've said there. Tell me what you see. Tell me how you take your pictures.
Yeah.
How do you create those pictures that seem sometimes so simple? And it's almost a question of less is more in your pictures.
Yes.
But there's just something about them, which was very nice of him to say. But I guess that there's two areas to that, because obviously there's some places that I know and know pretty well, but you can go back and see things in different light and different times of year, different conditions. And I think also different moods, because the mood, you know, the mood that you're in can often affect the way that you end up with a picture, what you see, how you feel, etc. And then there's places that you go to fresh that you've never been to before. And for my photography, it is pure sort of landscape, but it's also urban landscape as well, because obviously for me, it's much of my work. I think I started more because I was doing the walking and the climbing as a landscape photographer.
Yes.
But I've sort of done and enjoy, if I'm honest, more of the travel photography, of which landscape is a part. So I think, you know, whatever genre of photography you look at, I think many of them are difficult for different reasons. And I think for landscape, one of the key things is it's the light. You know, you are really dependent on the light Whereas obviously in a studio, you can control that.
Yeah.
But there are other challenges in a studio. And if you're a street photographer, then it's all about capturing that moment, and it's all about that technique, capturing the moment. And there are many different issues, I think, with and requirements to the different genres. So for me, I guess I'll go out and I'll take my time, and I'll get to a location, and I'll look around, and I'll just have a look around, and just see what catches my eye. And one of the things that I say to people that come out with me is, you know, they pick the camera up, and I say, well, why have you picked the camera up? What have you seen? What is it that's made you pick that camera up? Because what we can do now is we can try and emphasize that point, be it a tree, a rock and a tree combined, whatever it might be. Let's see how we can make even more of that to emphasize the beauty of that, the color, the tone, the texture, the movement, whatever it might be. Let's see how we can further develop that. And it was interesting when I was out with Colin last week. You know, it was just tiny things that made the difference between sort of a bit of a snap and something which he was actually came away and he was really quite pleased with. And it was, you know, little things just like just avoiding things in the background just by viewpoint, moving up and down. And we crouched down, and what was poking above the ridge line disappeared.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you're left with a much cleaner image. There's nothing competing. It's very clear to the viewer what you're trying to communicate to them and what you're wanting them to look at. So that's the sort of thing that I try and sort of communicate with people that come out with me, or you know, in the images that I take, really. Just try and make it very clear of what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. And one of the things, this is something that I came across a few weeks ago. Like when most people look at landscape photographers, they're usually seeing someplace far away from themselves. Like one of the photos that I absolutely adore was featured in that Fuji video. It is of a stone pathway.
Wadenlath,
I think is how you...
Wadenlath. It's in the Lake District, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, and... It's one of those things. It's like, wow, I wish I was there. I mean, the things that I could photograph while I'm there. And what a lot of people don't seem to catch on to is that there's plenty of places nearby that can, if you just take the time to look at, you'll get great photography. And what made me think of this is your trip to New Hampshire. And you went to a couple waterfalls. You went to Sabaday Falls, which I recognize.
Yep.
And you went to the basin in the Franconia Notch area.
Yes.
And this is something that I wanted to share with everybody. Just if you agree or disagree or have your own thoughts.
Perhaps because I was still using the Canon and the Olympus occasionally, it wasn't second nature.
Right.
And I think...
endlessly over photographed. The beauty about New Hampshire is that they make the natural wonders in the state so easily accessible, which is awesome. It's very, it's great for everybody to enjoy. And so what I love about this is that I'm seeing through your eyes how you would photograph something that I have seen photographed hundreds and hundreds of times. Mm. And so it's like you're telling your own personal story. You're sharing your own personal point of view of your image, and I think that is pretty remarkable, pretty special. And seeing how you see the same thing that everybody has seen hundreds of times, and just giving your personal spin on it.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, I think the thing is now so many people are into photography, which is great.
Yeah.
But it also means that there aren't really that many places, if any, that haven't been photographed, and almost there are some places that have been photographed to death. But if you've never been there before yourself, you're going to want to get the iconic view, whether that be at Sabaday Falls or you know, you're in Manhattan or you're in the Grand Canyon or wherever you are. You're going to want to get that iconic, if you like, the tripod hole shot, let's face it.
Yeah.
And there's nothing, my view is that there's nothing wrong with that, because if you've been there, you want to do that. But what I do that. But what I also feel then is that now the responsibility is on me to try and do something different. Look, try and find something a little bit different that's a bit original. And so I'm always quite keen to try and do that. And sometimes, you know, it falls into place, and other times it's a bit more difficult. But I think that's the key thing, to push yourself and stretch yourself and try and do a few other things. But, you know, we went to Acadia National Park as well, and that's another place that's a wonderful national park, super. And again, you know, you do the research before you go. And there are the classic sort of shots there, but again, it's nice to try and get something different for yourself. So it's a challenge, and that's what I enjoy.
Absolutely. My favorite photo from your North America series, I have to say, is the photograph of Roy's on Route 66.
Oh, yeah.
I just love like that old, I forget what that architecture is called, but
Yeah, it's sort of Art Deco, isn't it?
Art Deco,
Sort of,
yeah. I've heard it called different things, but did you photograph that in the Fuji Classic Chrome?
No. That, to be fair, that one was taken before the Fuji days.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that one was. So more than sort of 3 years ago. But no, it's well, it's just such an iconic place to go to and to find that. I think we were on our way down to Joshua Tree National Park actually, and past it. So it was great, and there was a few sort of. I've got a few. There's only so many pictures you can put on your website, and when you've taken thousands, it's very difficult. I've got some other nice ones as well from there, and there was a like an abandoned bus, and it was fun going in the bus and then shooting Roy's through the broken window, using that as a frame. So, you know, that's probably an example of doing something, you know, maybe a little bit differently as well,
Yeah.
of that same scene. So yeah, it's there's always something I think that you can do, no matter where you are, really, just to, and whether that's just the composition, whether that's the use of movement, whether that's, you know, you can move into things now like using intentional camera movement, multiple exposures. I've just come back from Lisbon, in Portugal, and I went out shooting early in the morning there because during the day the light was pretty harsh, and
Yeah.
so I went out early in the morning, and it's a wonderful city. It's sort of shabby chic. It's you know, it's great. It's got lots of character,
Shabby
and
chic, that should be a t-shirt.
absolutely. And lots of little alleyways with washing hanging out and stuff. And I love shooting in square. You probably see there's a few of my images on my website which are square, and I just love that square format. And I was shooting square, and I just thought with the Fuji, and I just thought, do you know what? I like the format, but I'm going to play around with some of the advanced filter modes. So I just activated those, and the first one in the list was toy camera, an Olympus OMD EM5, I think it was the first one. Beautiful cameras, slightly. Gives a warmer tone to the image and gives it a darker vignette. And I just snapped a couple of pictures, and you know, they look wonderful. It just worked with that faded glory, you know, the old tiled front of these buildings that were sort of crumbling away a little bit, and street corners with signs, and the trams, the washing, and it just worked really well. And then I shot, I don't know, a couple of hundred images over the 4 days that I was there. I shot more than that, but using this technique, I shot a couple of hundred, and I've written a blog for Fujifilm, and that's going to be published in the next week or so. So if anyone's follows the Fujifilm blog, then you'll see that very shortly. But it was fascinating to get a series of pictures which were a bit creative, a bit different, and you know, in a certain style. And that in itself helps us. So, you know, it wasn't just using the standard 3:2 settings and then doing things in post-processing. It was capturing it in camera. So there are things that you can do very differently, even if you're in the most popular of places
I never
around the
thought
world.
to use those filters.
Yeah. And most people don't. And that's the whole point of this blog that I've written, just to say, you know, don't close your eyes to these things, because there are occasions. And the other thing that you know, you can do is use the multiple exposure as well. And one of the things that I like doing there is take, I mean, the Fuji system allows you to take two images and overlay them. So, you know, take one, and then the second one you can, you know, either defocus or change the white balance, change the exposure, or just move it slightly out of register, because when you've taken the first image, you get the ghost image.
Yes.
So you can line it up, so you can just deregister it, or you can have the second image with some in-camera movement. Or one of the things I like to do is take a texture. So when I was in Cinque Terre in Italy, taking a picture of a lovely seaside village, and I overlaid that with a texture of the pebble beach. So it's just things like, and the two link together because they're at the same place, but it just created like a texture. It's fun. Sometimes they work, sometimes they don't, but it's just fun just to do something a little bit differently. And you can do that in camera.
That's amazing. So that being said, how much post-processing did you do with the Canon series that you used in the past, and how much do you do now with the Fuji?
Yeah, I guess when I was using the Canon, I used to use Photoshop, but not heavily. I mean, I wasn't into importing skies and doing stuff like that. It was basic tweaks, really. You know, it was the standard stuff, levels and curves and maybe a bit of cloning, cropping, straightening, that sort of thing. And I guess I've been using Lightroom now for the past 4 or 5 years, and most of my processing is done through Lightroom. I do sometimes then take things into Photoshop, depends what needs doing, and then bring them back into Lightroom. So, but mostly I would say 80% of my images are just processed in Lightroom, and I have a series of workflow that I stick to. And again, it's, you know, within Lightroom there's obviously a limit, there's no layers in Lightroom, there's a limit to what you can do, but
yeah.
I find that Lightroom gives me most things that I want, and the trick, I think, is to try and get as much as you can right in camera. But of course, with the developments in the software now, with things like the merge to HDR and the pano modes, which seem on the surface very simple, but I'm sure all the algorithms and the maths and the science behind it are very much more complicated than that. And but they deliver very good results. You know, they're super. And there's the recent things like the dehaze filter, which is quite useful as well.
Yeah,
which you can use both ways. You can dehaze and you can add some haze in if you want, of course, which is quite useful. And then the latest thing is the guides, the crop guides, which is just superb. So often, you know, when I'm doing travel and you're either in churches or you're taking pictures of architecture, lots of old doors and things outside, you don't quite get it lined up. So using the crop to guides tool now in Lightroom and Photoshop just absolutely gets those bang on. So it's amazing, really, the way things have come on in the last few years.
Yeah. Wow, awesome. Hold on for just one moment. Had one little audio snafu there.
Okay.
We're all good. I'll just have to write down what time stamp that was on. Okay. So most of the, I mean, roughly would you say, like you, there's just with the Fuji system, it's just minor tweaks here and there for photo editing.
I think it really depends on the shot, Mark. So that, you know, it depends. For example, if you know, I was doing some shots in Lisbon, across Lisbon at dawn and dusk,
yeah,
and wanting to capture detail in the sky, but also the shadow areas of the rooftops, you know, in front of me as well. So you're never going to get that all right in one exposure. So your options basically are to use either ND grad filters. But then if you've got a skyline like I'd got with a church and various other things, you know, poking up, it's difficult to use them. So in that particular case, you know, you've got to do multiple exposures and then blend them together to make sure that you've captured the detail in the highlights and the shadows. So in that particular case, it's probably a little bit more than if I've done a portrait or if I've done a straight picture of, a shuttered window or something like that. So I guess it's really difficult to say. It depends on the image. It depends on the lighting conditions, really.
Right. Very cool. Mm. Getting back to the Thorsby
Colliery. Yeah, it's a pit. Coal mine.
That's been in business, in the mining business for 900 years.
Yeah, so what happened? I live in the Midlands. I live in Nottinghamshire, in the centre of the UK. And I mean, as probably many of your listeners are aware, that the coal was an integral part of Britain's development, and certainly through the sort of 19th and into the 20th century.
Yeah.
And there were hundreds of pits around the country, and there were a lot in the central part of the world where I live. And then through a variety of economic and political decisions, the coal mines have been shut. And this colliery, which is about 20 minutes from where I live, called Thoresby Colliery, happened to be the second to last colliery in the country, deep mine, to close. But it was the last one in Nottinghamshire. And that brought to an end 900 years of mining in the county. So it was a significant event in the history of the county, and, you know, had many, many social implications as well on the workforce, etc. And what had happened was that I do a lot of lectures to local camera clubs around the country. But in this particular case, I happened to be lecturing in Nottingham. And a guy came up to me afterwards and said, really like your pictures. How would you fancy an introduction to take some pictures at Thoresby Colliery before it closes? And this is back in 2014 now. And I said, yeah, that would be fantastic. This guy was a miner who was in the first wave of redundancies. But he said, look, I've got a contact. I'll put him in touch with you, and you'll be able to go along. So that's what happened. So that was my introduction. And I sort of went along, and I thought that it was probably going to get one or two visits and that'd be it. And I thought it'd just be interesting just to have a look around and get a few different sorts of images for my portfolio.
Yeah.
And really my passion is really travel and landscape, as we've talked about. So social documentary was just totally, you know, I'd never done a social documentary project before. And a project really, as this turned out eventually to develop into. So I went along and had a chat with the guys there, and they seemed pretty receptive. And I said to them, look, you know, am I likely to get more than one visit here, or is this just going to be today? And they said, well, no, you know, you can come if you want to come a few times, you can do. And so I said, fine, okay, well, what I'd like to do is just have a wander around the site. I'm not going to take my tripod, I'm going to take some snapshots. And what I really wanted to do was just understand the whole process, the way that the coal mine worked, where the coal came up, what the miners were doing, what the buildings were for, you know, the whole sort of workflow process, so that I could then, from that, it was a recce, basically, so that I could then go away and pull together. I'd already done a bit of a shoot list on sort of the sorts of shots that I thought I could get, because I tend to be pretty organized, not any trip I do, I'll have a shoot list. And then it was a question of refining that, and then deciding, you know, making a few decisions in terms of how I wanted to try and take this series of photos, but still thinking I might get two or three visits. And what happened was, from July 2014 till July 2015, when the mine closed on July the 10th, 2015, was that I actually went 10 times for between maybe 2 and 3 hours at a time. So you can imagine, took quite a few images. And it was fascinating. It was personally wonderful, because I would never have visited a coal mine and never had an experience of that. So to go there and witness that, and witness the last one, which was a bit of a landmark event in the social and industrial history of the county, was great. And therefore, I just felt that, having been given that time, I'd got sort of a responsibility to make sure that I captured this well, and that there had to be an output as well, because I wanted to share this. And I've done a number of exhibitions before, and so I know how to handle those. And I just thought, well, I need an exhibition. And then it was, well, it'd be nice to do like an exhibition catalogue of 40 or 50 pictures that are in the exhibition. And it sort of snowballed from there, because I'd taken that many pictures that I just thought, well, what am I going to do with the rest?
Yeah.
It'd be nice to be able to do a proper book. And that's what eventually happened. I did a book with I think it's 138 pages, over 200 images in there, and an exhibition. And, you know, the book has gone extremely well. It's already been to reprint. And this was self-published, so this was a huge project.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it was a question of getting some sponsorship and some support. And again, another learning for me. But having done one, you know, I know what's required now, and you know, maybe there'll be another one. So really, from just that brief introduction, which I have to say was, it was quite fortunate. You know, this huge project has unfolded, and it's had now three exhibitions. I'm at a local university going tomorrow to talk to a group of European academics about my project, because they're debating the demise of coal across Europe. So it's amazing the different things that have come up as a result of this, and really what it's done for my profile, including obviously talking to you.
Thank you. This is such fascinating photography, and one thing that immediately strikes me is just how different the style of photography is. Did you photograph all of these photos using the Fuji Native black and white, or did you do the conversions afterwards?
No, I did the conversions after. So the whole project was shot entirely on Fujifilm cameras. It would be the X-T1 primarily, 90% of the shots, X-T1, and then the X-E1 would have filled in a few, using a range of lenses. So I tend to use the zooms quite a lot, actually. So I've got the 10-24, the 18-55, 55-200. But then I also used a couple of, I've got a few primes, but the two that I used most were the 35mm 1.4 at the time. I've subsequently upgraded to the F2, and also the 56mm 1.2 for some portraits. And they were just absolutely superb. I mean, the quality from those was phenomenal. And, you know, my exhibition featured A2 prints framed. You know, lots of people have commented on the quality that's come out of the Fuji system, and the way that the prints have printed up is, I have to say, I'm extremely pleased. But no, they were all taken raw, and they were all converted, and it was one of the first decisions that I took. I mean, it just seemed a no-brainer to photograph the coal industry in black and white, and for a couple of reasons as well.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. If you, you know, if you look at some of the pictures, because this colliery was built in 1925, and, you know, probably since it's been developed, obviously since then, but a lot of the buildings, a lot of the shots that you see on the website could have been taken in the 70s.
Yeah.
And I think black and white lends itself to that timeless feel. And the other thing, of course, is that the guys wore bright orange safety clothing. Which you know, if you shoot in color, your eye goes straight to the orange.
Yeah.
And I didn't want that. So what I wanted was for people. I wanted what I was trying to achieve was a harsh, gritty feel to complement the harsh grittiness of the industry, but with some sensitivity. You know, and I looked around at the work of people like, you know, David Bailey, who'd done a project on the valleys in the Welsh coal mines in the 60s or 70s, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the work of Don McCullen, the war photographer. And I was thinking I want to get some harshness, grittiness that reflects the industry, but it also needs to be handled sensitively as well. And, you know, I hope I've done that. I've had lots of good feedback on it, but so I hope that's come across really.
I see that warm quality. I don't know if that's the right word, but in your portraits that you did with everybody. So I from my point of view, I see the grittiness of the work life, and but once you get those portraits in there, they're extremely detailed, and but they still have that humanity to them. And What was that like doing these portraitures? When was it difficult taking that step away from the regular landscape travel work?
Well, it's really interesting this because as a travel photographer, you have to be adept in many different genres, and you know that can be landscape, it can be architecture, it can be people portraits, it can be candid, it can be food. You know, detail, flora, fauna, all these things are thrown at you as a travel photographer because you're trying to capture the spirit, the ambience of the place, just the feel of the place. And so in a funny sort of way, being able to do landscape shots, architectural shots, people shots, really played into my hand on this project because I had to do all of those.
Yeah.
So, you know, I do have experience in taking people pictures, and it's a good point because what I did in this particular case was I started off with the project because after a couple of visits, it became apparent that I was going to be able to continue to visit. So what I then did was I thought, well, I'll concentrate on the buildings and do the people later. When I've built up a bit of a rapport with them, because you started to see the same people around.
Yeah.
And they got used to me. I got used to them. And in Britain, we have what the guys call the pit banter. It's the fun, you know, it's the mickey taking between each other. And I was at the end of that, you know, they were taking the mickey out of me. The trick was to give as good as you get, because if you don't, you go under, you know, it's like that.
All right, I got to ask, what does it mean to get the mickey taken out of you?
Well, it's just the jokes, you know, just you're the butt of the jokes, and you know, they'll pull all sorts of pranks and things on you, and
nice.
And say things, but yeah, so it was all in jest, but it was, you know, it's great. But it was interesting because at the beginning, when I asked a few people, you know, can I take your picture, they'd say, oh, not today, mate, you know, no, another time, because they felt a bit self-conscious. But you know, towards the end, when the guys knew that, you know, in the next 4 weeks the colliery was closing, the next 2 weeks, the next week, and the key day for me was the penultimate day. It was the 9th of July, the day before they finished coal production. And I went up and I set up one studio flash in this room. And I went at the shift change time when the morning shift were coming off shift, so they were all blackened faces. The afternoon shift were going on, they were all clean. And virtually everybody who was either going on shift or came off had their portrait taken, because they realized that this is going to be probably the last picture that I have taken, a formal sort of portrait of me, you know, before in my work, you know, in the mine. And the other thing is that for many of these people, it was quite an emotional, although they were very big, strong guys, miners, tough as old boots. But you've got to remember that some of these guys had worked there for 25, 30 years, maybe more. But not only that, their fathers had worked down the mines, and their grandfathers had worked down the mines.
Yeah.
So the fact that the mining industry was coming to a close was a huge thing for the family, not only the guys, but for the family. And that emotion started to come through towards the end. You know, you could tell, and guys were talking about what was going to happen to them when the mine, when they finished work, et cetera, et cetera. And certainly in those last couple of days, I went on the last day as well, you know, it was tangible. You could feel it. And you know, it was great, and I hope that in the miners' eyes of the portraits that I've done, the formal portraits, I think you can see that when I talk to you about that now, and you look at some of those pictures, you can detect that. And then similarly, there's pictures that I'd taken earlier on of guys, you know, environmental portraits, electricians working, you know, welders. You know, guys, you know, working in the various different workshops, the mechanical workshop or whatever it might be, just going about their tasks. But yeah, it was a fascinating project, and it became much more about the people, not so much about the plant, the machinery,
right,
and the buildings, which I was pleased with.
What is the community like now after the closure?
Well, that's a good question, because when I first went up, what used to happen with these villages was that they grew up in this particular case, it was sort of early 1900s. And what happened was when they sunk a mine, there was a little community that was built around the coal mine. And, you know, the mine was the community was the mine, and that was it. But in this particular case, because Thoresby was the last one, what had happened was that miners had migrated from other pits that had closed but still lived in their communities. So what had happened was a lot of people were driving in to the Thoresby Colliery from where they lived. So there wasn't that sort of very tight-knit community feel that you got with, you know, mines in previous years, and certainly the sort of thing that you would see in the Welsh valleys, where, you know, you've got a valley with a mine and the whole community revolved around that mine, and you'd got social clubs and you'd got brass bands, and you'd you know, you've got lots of things there that went on around that community. That wasn't quite the case in Thorsby's situation, which was a bit disappointing. It would have been nice to have got that angle. And that was one of the things that I decided then that I wasn't going to try and capture. I just thought I'm just going to concentrate purely and solely on the site, as opposed to, you know, the community. I'd thought of maybe going into miners' homes and doing that sort of thing, but I thought I wouldn't do that.
Yeah. Very cool. Well, it's a very, very strong, just powerful work, and I'm at a loss for words. It's just so powerful. Such a contrast from your other work, but it is just so beautiful.
Yeah, and I talk about challenges. You know, I talked about that early on, and I do thrive on a challenge, and it is different, and it's good. And I think in some ways that's really worked for me, because doing something like that, I know, okay, you know, not everyone can do a project with such a strong backstory as the last pit in their state or their county to close, you know, bringing to an end all those years of industry and mining. But there are things that you can do. And I think it's really good to do a project like this, because whether it's the shopkeepers in your town or your church or your local community, your local football team or whatever it might be, there is, you know, if you sit down and think about it and plan the different shots, it's a good way of stretching yourself. And it certainly stretched me. As I say, I'd never done a social documentary project before, and it certainly sort of opened many more doors for me. And it's gone very, very well. So I could certainly wholeheartedly recommend it to any photographer out there to give it a go.
Excellent. I can't wait to see future projects, because this is just gorgeous.
Thank you.
Finally, I just wanted to thank you again for being on the show. It was such a pleasure having you on. Why don't you tell the audience where they could find you on the web?
Yeah, sure. So my website is chrisuptonphotography.com, all one word, chrisuptonphotography.com. So they can see me there. And then there's links from on my website to Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, etc. That's probably the best thing.
Excellent. And if you want to see just a quick sneak peek, go over to any of Fujifilm's YouTube channels. I believe it's Fujifilm UK to see that awesome vignette that they did of
there's
you.
There's a video on there, and I'm also featured on the Fujifilm ex-photographers website as well, where you've got all the ex-photographers from around the world. You should check that out for some inspirational photography taken on Fuji cameras. And you can organize by photographer or by country, and you'll find me there as well.
Excellent. Chris, it was awesome having you on, and maybe, you know, on your next project, come back on and share your story again.
Be delighted to, Mark. Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. I gotta say, interviewing Chris was an absolute thrill. Not only am I a huge fan of his photography, but the man is just sharp as a tack and a complete gentleman. And it was funny during the interview. I had a lot of follow-up questions to ask him, but during the course of my questioning, I mean, he was just going on and answering everything before I could even ask it. So it was a lot of silence on my part. But oh my God, it was such a great experience, and I had such a great time interviewing him. Real hero of mine as far as the photography goes, and you know, what can I say? He was an absolute treat to talk to. So one of the things I wanted to share with you before we close this episode is something that I'm going to do this weekend. I am going on a wonderful camping trip with my family, and I absolutely cannot wait. We're heading up into the White Mountains, and we're going to take advantage of some much-needed R&R. We just want to get away, relax. It's been quite a busy season, actually. Not that I'm complaining. It's been wonderful photographing all these weddings and playing around with, you know, brand new
combinations of Fuji gear as well as the Canon gear, but let's face it, this isn't the Canon show. So what I'm going to do this weekend is I'm going to be as minimalist as possible. I'm leaving all heavy gear behind, and I am simply going to bring my iPhone and my Fuji X100, and I'm going to bring the X100 50mm attachment just for a little flavor, but otherwise it's just those two cameras that I'm going to be playing with. So any landscape photography that I'm going to be doing is going to be limited to just, you know, just the iPhone and the X100T, I should be more specific. And I'm looking forward to it. I just purchased, and it should be arriving tomorrow, a nice L bracket to put onto my tripod for the X100. So that'll make things nice and easy and convenient and much easier to hold the X100. Not that I have a problem with the camera itself, but it is a little small in my hands. A little bit. It's just missing that one little piece of oomph to make it comfortable. And I think this L bracket will be really nice, give me that perfect feel for the camera. And I absolutely cannot wait. I'm going to photograph as many waterfalls as I can. I'm also going to do absolutely nothing. That's also very important. Just kick back and enjoy the scenery. But one of the days I'm planning to at least photograph one waterfall. I have the X100. I have various neutral density filters. So I don't know which one I'm going to photograph, but I will be sure to share those photos with you guys. And I'm planning to do a little video on it as well. And what better way to announce a cool video is that I have launched officially the X-Line YouTube channel. You'll have to go into the show notes, go to thexline.com, and you'll be able to find the link directly to the X-Line. And right now I have the previous interviews of the photographers that I spoke with. So I have, there'll be this episode with Chris Upton. I have Andrew Billington and Kevin Mullins up there as well. So it's brand new. I'm happy to announce it. I'm going to put the podcast feed in there, but I'm also going to do periodically some videos and some highlights of some photos that I've taken and share with you my experience with them. And hopefully you guys will check it out, like and subscribe if it's cool. But otherwise, you know, check it out. Enjoy. Well, that's all for this week. Once again, thank you for listening. If you enjoyed the show, go on and head on over to iTunes and leave us a 5-star rating. That always helps us in the search results for new people looking for Fujifilm podcasts. And once again, go ahead and check out the YouTube channel. Head on over to thexline.com for show notes and links to the channel. Also, you could hit us up on iTunes or Instagram. Just search us out. We are Xline Show on both platforms. And if you want to shoot us an email, you could do so by sending it to xlineshow@gmail.com and share your stories of the Fujifilm series. It's always awesome to hear your experiences using the Fuji system. And so that's it. That's all for this week. I can't wait to share my vacation stories with you guys, as well as my early summer, late summer wedding photography fun. Once again, I've tested out a whole bunch of combinations of Fuji X gear, and you know, I'm just biding my time to get that all squared away on paper, and you know, just sort out my thoughts and experiences, and then I will share it with you guys on the show very soon. And I will definitely get it to you guys before the fall season. The fall season here in New England is pretty intense. Always fun, but man, it's a lot of work. But that's it. That's all for this week. Once again, thank you very much for listening. It's always great to hear from you guys, and I'm just so glad that you guys are enjoying the show. And we'll see you next time. All music for this episode comes from Bensound. For royalty-free music, check out bensound.com.